Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Stephen Waldman, co-founder of BeliefNet, author of the new book, Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicot. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. It has been a beautiful, verdant spring here in southern Arizona where I live. It hasn't yet gotten hot. While the Palo Verde, the all-green trees, are filled with yellow flowers, and the cacti are blooming in reds and whites, while the earlier multicolor floral displays from plantings and wildflowers are still very much in evidence, it's a good time to enjoy the magnificence of the natural world with which God has blessed us. It's a good time to be alive. Which makes the news reports the last couple of weeks even more disturbing. About 10 days after the synagogue shooting in Poway, California, we had another school shooting, this one a Denver suburb not far from Columbine, Colorado, where this whole recent pattern of shooting innocents in school and at prayer seems to have begun. A student and a former student walked into a high school and started shooting kids, yet again. There's an insanity afoot in our country and our world that refuses to recede. It somehow communicates the message that it's acceptable, if you are angry or upset or unhinged, to just go and shoot people who can't defend themselves. The best place to do this appears to be where people are studying or praying. And for some reason, deranged people, always men, decide to grab a gun and walk into a place of worship or study and shoot and kill children, older people, women, men, anybody they can. It should be beyond comprehension, but it has begun to seem, well, sickeningly routine. I'll wager most of us don't remember the name of the recent school that was shot up. And while the name of the synagogue attacked last week, Chabad of Poway, may be familiar to us now, I suspect in a few months or weeks it will fade from our consciousness too, as will the churches and mosques that were shot up or blown up in recent months. Back to school shootings. The other day, I tried to remember the name of the elementary school in Connecticut that we thought would end this awfulness forever, in which the wholesale slaughter of little children and their teachers had to create momentum to stop this terrible trend. I remembered that it was in Newtown, Connecticut, but it took a while before the name Sandy Hook came to mind. In that horrific attack, 20 first graders were murdered and 6 adults. It was such a horror that the school, which was then pretty new, was eventually bulldozed. We really believed something would change after Sandy Hook. That was 6.5 years ago. All that has changed is that we now have far more school shootings. Now brutal attacks on religious institutions have become more common as well. You know, I did a little macabre survey of how common school shootings have become in America. The data goes back to the mid-1800s. It shows that while school shootings existed, well, they have existed for quite a long time, they remained very uncommon until recently. In the whole decade of the 1940s, there were a total of 6 school shootings recorded, 4 of them, oddly, in New York City. In the decade of the 1950s, that rose to 16 school shootings spread all around the country. Most of these resulted in one or perhaps 2 fatalities, usually including the shooter. In the 1960s, this rose only slightly, 17 school shootings, but one of those was the brutal University of Texas clock tower killing that murdered 15 and wounded 13 others. In the 1970s, we rose to 30 school shootings, with more multiple fatality school attacks. One of those with multiple deaths was Kent State, which caused a national crisis and inspired a durable rock song. By the 1980s, we went up to 41 school shootings. By the 90s, there were 62 shootings in American schools, including Columbine, which killed 15 and wounded 22. The 2000s brought an additional 64 school shootings, including the Virginia Tech massacre of 32 students, which wounded an additional 23, the deadliest school shooting to date in American history. But the 2010s have exploded with 191 school shootings, including Sandy Hook and Parkland, Florida, where 17 high school students were murdered and another 17 wounded just last year. Think about it. In the 1940s, the decade of World War II and the Holocaust, there were a total of 6 school shootings in America in the whole decade. In the 2010s, a decade in which wars have been far from our borders, there have been close to 200 school shootings. That's an average of nearly 2 a month, every month, for 10 years. I don't know the answer for how to stop this insanity. I do know that children need to be able to learn without fearing for their lives, that parents must know their kids are safe at school. Our educational institutions cannot become literally war zones, which, frankly, they are becoming. I do know that we need to keep guns out of the hands of insane people, of course. I know that we need better and more available mental health counseling and institutions for those who are unbalanced. I also know that we obviously need to have more and better security at our schools, which is incredibly depressing. You know, for most kids, school always seems a bit like prison. Are schools now going to actually become closer to prisons in reality, as hard to get in and out of as airports and detention facilities? Most of all, it is evident that there is something very, very wrong in our society. My friends, we are all created B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God. It cannot be the case that we are raising children, boys especially it seems, to believe that under any circumstances ever it is acceptable to bring a gun into a school and shoot students or teachers or administrators. And what began at schools is now bleeding into churches, mosques, and synagogues. It cannot be the case that people internalize the message that whenever they are angry or afraid or have hatred in them, it is now the acceptable American pattern to take that out on the nearest soft target with a gun, to attack a school or a house of prayer. We must protect our kids. But we must also examine our own hearts and our society, and address the evil that has situated itself there. We have to find a way to replace it with good, to shine a light into that deep darkness and change the world and ourselves for the better, because this is us, Americans, who are doing this. And we must do so openly, honestly, now. This is the period of the counting of the Omer, the late spring, when we are between Pesach, Passover, the Festival of Freedom, and Shavuot, Shavuos, the holiday commemorating receiving the Torah at Mount Sinai, the Feast of Weeks. The Sfirat HaOmer, the counting of the Omer, is a time of personal preparation in Jewish tradition, when we move from freedom to responsibility, from absolute freedom to covenant, always seeking to improve. On that subject, and to play us in this morning, here's a song from Israeli artist Ishai Ribo, Achat Ulatamid, a song to God. I wish to do as your will, as you wish, really and truly, once and for all, with no screens, no masks, without wanting to please, really and truly, once and for all. אחת ולתמיד.
שוב הרגע הזה אני אתה ויצרי, אין לי פנים להפנות יותר, גם לא תירוצים, גם לא תירוצים. והלכתי לאיבוד בתוך שוק עומי אדם, עמוק בתוך זוטה של ים, אבל אני יודע שלא תתייאש ממני לעולם. שונסתי מפניך כמו אידיוט, ברחתי להרים, בניתי מסביבי חומות, מגדלים, חדרי חדרים, חדרי חדרים. האמת אני בוש ונכלם, הדבר שמפניך נעלם, מלך חי וקיים, מלך חי וקיים. ואני רוצה לעשות רצונך כרצונך, באמת ובתמים, אחת ולתמיד, בלי מסכים, בלי מסכות, בלי לרצות, לרצות, באמת ובתמים, אחת ולתמיד. שוב הרגע הזה, אני ליבי ובשרי, אין לי מילים להגיד יותר, גם לא חרוזים, גם לא חרוזים. הנה פרעתי את עצמי בפניך לפרוטות, מדבר גבוהה גבוהה, אבל עושה מעט מאוד, עושה מעט מאוד. וחזרתי לסורי ושגיתי באומרי, ששוב לא אכתב ואשוב, לא אכתב ואשוב, לא אכתב ואשוב, ואיך שהוא סיפקת בידי שוב. ואני רוצה לעשות רצונך כרצונך, באמת ובתמים, אחת ולתמיד, בלי מסכים, בלי מסכות, בלי לרצות, לרצות, באמת ובתמים, אחת ולתמיד. ואני רוצה לעשות רצונך כרצונך, באמת ובתמים, אחת ולתמיד, בלי מסכים, בלי מסכות, בלי לרצות, לרצות, באמת ובתמים, אחת ולתמיד.
That was Ishai Ribo singing Achat Ulatamid, once and always I wish to be myself truly with you, God, honestly. Our guest this morning, Stephen Waldman, is an author and entrepreneur. He's the co-founder of BeliefNet, author of the new book, Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom. Religious freedom in America has not always been an automatic. Find out how it was achieved when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Stephen Waldman is the author of the new book, Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom. He's the national best-selling author of Founding Faith, co-founder of BeliefNet, a writer who has appeared in almost every authoritative publication in America, and is an entrepreneur as well. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So a stereotype, when I always kind of grew up learning as a kid, was that the Founding Fathers instilled religious liberty in every important document and that America has always been a place of great religious liberty. That is not entirely the whole story.
Yeah, alas, we really haven't had robust religious liberty for most of our history. The first 150 years or so before the Founding Fathers got there were sort of experiments in theocracy and having state churches, and didn't work too well. And then even once the Founding Fathers came along and we had the First Amendment, it turns out that really was just the first step. At the point of the Revolution, 9 of the 13 colonies banned Jews and Catholics from holding office. So that gives you a sense of just that we had a long way to go, and it really took another 200 years of struggle, including by religious minorities, to make the concepts that are laid out in the First Amendment really come to life.
I was fascinated to learn that the states really had the ability to restrict religious liberty in spite of what appeared to be in the First Amendment,
And in spite of what most of us kind of learned, you know, wow, the George Washington's letter to the Touro Synagogue, we've always had religious liberty. But that wasn't a national, that didn't change for a while. Can you describe that process a little bit?
Yeah, there was basically, we tend to think of the First Amendment as sort of a sacred document that came straight from James Madison's head or pen and went right to the National Archives. It was a political document. Remember, the First Amendment as an amendment went through Congress first. And it went through all the same processes that things go through Congress on. And what happened specifically with this was that Madison wanted it to apply to the states, but he lost. We don't think of, you know, we think of these guys as having kind of a preemptory power, but he was one vote. And basically, the people in the states that had state religions, like, for instance, in Connecticut, the Congregational Church was sort of the official church. Those people said, we don't want this First Amendment to be messing with the way we do things in Connecticut. And Madison reluctantly agreed. He said, okay, that's what I need to get this through as First Amendment. So the First Amendment really just restricted the federal government's ability to infringe on religious liberty. So it wasn't until the 14th Amendment, that was the one that happened right after the Civil War, that applied or started to apply the principles of the First Amendment to local issues. And by local, I mean everything from the school board, all the things that we tend to talk about, you know, a creche on the town square and things like that. Those are all local issues. Those were not really brought to fore as religious liberty issues in the U.S. Constitution until after the 14th Amendment. And then even then, it took another 100 years or so before the courts got serious about enforcing that.
And we will talk much more about that and about religious liberty in America today in our conversation with Steve Waldman. We come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community striving every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone through the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study is at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great Hebrew school and Torah Tikes programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its wonderful beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, you're off to Morocco and Spain on a kind of Jewish heritage trip, among other things. It's not too hard to find where Jewish services are held in Morocco. There's a Jewish community in Casablanca. There's a synagogue in Marrakesh. They have Shabbat services. But Spain is kind of an interesting problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's proving to be somewhat of a challenge. I'm leading a group, and we will spend one Shabbat in Marrakesh, which isn't problematic. It's easy to find the synagogue and the schedule of services, whatever. Even though the Jewish community there is small, there are a lot of Jewish tourists and visitors. So there's regularly a minyan. And even kosher food is available actually throughout Morocco, because a lot of Israelis of Moroccan origin visit Morocco regularly, and particularly during Passover, because the Moroccan festival at the very end of Passover,
Mimouna, the great Mimouna festival,
apparently can't be the real deal anywhere outside of Morocco. Right. So Israelis of Moroccan origin go back really for that, but because Passover is a week-long holiday in Israel, they take the whole week, they go on organized tours.
Right, right.
Most of the tour guides in Morocco speak at least basic Hebrew, and some of these tourists care about the dietary laws and whatever, so hotels convert, and oddly, in every big city in Morocco, you can find hotels that are kosher for Passover, which is not necessarily the case in the U.S.
I mean, we have definitely
a far bigger Jewish community. I don't know how many hotels in Chicago or L.A., which are huge Jewish centers, actually have kosher for Passover kitchens.
There might be one or two that do. But boy, you know, it must be Tirbachu v'tisadu. You know, that's the big celebration of Moon in Morocco. Very interesting that it's such a magnet for Moroccan Jews to return.
It is. And it's complicated for them to get a visa because they can only do so in a group, or they have to stop at a Moroccan embassy somewhere else. If they're doing individual travel, they have to stop because there's no Moroccan embassy in Israel. So they have to stop like in Spain or something. It's not an easy thing, particularly for an individual Israeli traveler, which is why they tend to go in groups.
Although I have to say Israeli travelers are uniquely resourceful travelers in general. So Morocco, that's pretty clear that you can find the Jewish sites, that they're significant. You know, what was fascinating to me in Morocco, even though it's a tiny fraction of the Jewish community that once was there, which was many hundreds of thousands, might have been a million at one point, before so many of them came to either Israel or France or America or Canada. But Spain is such a different animal that way, such a different experience.
Right. So let me just say, in terms of numbers, the biggest number I've ever seen for the Moroccan Jewish population in the past was 250,000. But when you look at all the Jews of Moroccan descent in Israel and Canada and France and all over the world, that just number seems too small.
Seems
somehow
like there's more than that in Tel Aviv. Like, how could that possibly be?
Right. So you never know. I mean, it could be exactly the case, as we were discussing last week, of Ukraine, where the official number is also 250,000. But locals tell me, depending on how you define a Jew, there's at least 600,000. So you never really know with population figures. You never know what the criteria were used. Was the census taken to minimize or to maximize the apparent Jewish population, et cetera, et cetera. But you're absolutely right that Spain is another story, and we should get to that next week.
Sounds good. We'll talk then.
I look forward.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sydney says to his friend Moshe, "We were so poor when I was young, I had to sleep in the same bed as my three brothers. We were four to a bed for many, many years. You know, I didn't know what it was like to sleep alone until I grew up and got married." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniyot, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benakot, young representatives of Israel here in America. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So Eurovision, right? Like the biggest thing to hit Israel since, I don't know, cable TV. It's a big deal. Tell us how Israelis feel about it. This is Israel obviously won Eurovision last year. That's why it's hosting this year.
So I think, like, we weren't in Israel for the past year, but from what I heard from the media and the, like, social media and the news, it's a really big thing. They're really, like, getting prepared for it, like, 6 months in advance, like, the people, not the government, of course. And also, I think for us, the Shin Shiniyot and also in other communities, it's really important to take this as a opportunity to give information about Israel and to teach about Israel. And when there are big events in Israel happening, we can educate other kids like that we work with about it and talk about Israeli music on the way. And I think it's a really big
It's an opportunity to teach about Israeli music, which is a really important part of culture. Eurovision, of course, big international song festival, every European country. And Israel counts as a European country, which is an interesting thing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In this area. I don't think they're going to get to join. Not sure who's joining Europe these days, but still. Are any of your friends going to be able to go to any of the? I assume that there's like a series of tryouts, right? The concerts, kind of, and then they vote, and everybody votes.
So I don't know anyone that is going to go. It's really expensive, also, and it's really like competitive. You know, a lot of people want to be there. A lot of people want to get the tickets. I believe they already started selling the tickets.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Yeah, and it's crazy. I mean, I've seen this. Talk show about how they sell the tickets, and it's just crazy. They prepare it ahead of how they're going to do it without making anyone, you know, like
too crazy.
Yeah,
it has to be kind of a lottery system. It's complicated.
It's
right?
So complicated.
They're televising it live in Israel, right?
Right.
Television, so everybody will be watching.
Exactly.
It'll be like the World Cup. Last
year it was crazy.
And so the song this year's entry, which. Who knows who's going to win, right? We don't know yet.
Yeah.
It doesn't start till, what, Monday or Tuesday, I guess. What do you think of this year's entry?
So I didn't really like the song just because... So the way they picked the song and whoever's going to sing it is in a reality show, kind of like America Got Talent
or
The Voice, exactly. And I just thought there was a candidate. Exactly. I just thought there was a different candidate that could do like a better job representing Israel. And
did he write the song?
I think other people.
Kobi Marimi. Right.
I think other people wrote it for him. It's called Home. Listen to it.
Yeah. Well, you can find it on YouTube, and pretty soon you'll see it publicized everywhere. Well, we wish Israel luck, but mostly we hope it's a great contest and a big success in terms of people coming and enjoying Israel and enjoying this exciting Eurovision contest 2019.
Yeah.
You should watch it. You should watch the Eurovision. It's a great contest. I know not a lot of people in America know it, but you should watch it. It's really
okay.
Cool.
Recommended here on Too Jewish. Thanks, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. Emor, our portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do. God gives commands to the people of Israel, but the language this time is different. Usually, commandments begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel, or occasionally tzav, command the children of Israel. This time, the much softer word emor, say to the priests, the children of Aaron, is used. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of the first sentence of our portion. The Seder actually begins, say to the priests, and then adds, and say to them. As the commentators don't believe the Torah is ever redundant, the Talmud teaches that there is a subtle message here. Be cautious in how we adults speak to children. Emor means speak softly but kindly. Good advice in instructing children at any time. But why specifically is this word emor used twice in regard to the priestly commands? The priests, after all, are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness given to our ancestors, articulated forcefully at the start of last week's portion of Kiddushim. You shall all be holy, for I, God, am holy. Here in emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to softer language is notable. The priests are the ones who actually have to help people achieve holiness. They now must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements, but also inspired to do that work with devotion and passion. There will be a balance they must maintain between conscientious, obsessive attention to detail and finding a way to communicate the sacredness of their calling to the Jewish people, who are not as occupied with its process and may not be as emotionally invested in it as they.
Thus, the word used here is emor, speak, explain, teach, inspire, not simply daber, tell, command, order, require. In leading anyone to holiness, there has to be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality. Badly performed rituals inspire no one. But there must also be a demonstrated process of caring about the way those processes are experienced by the devotees, even, perhaps especially, a love for both the process and the result. This week of Emor, may we be inspired to seriously and caringly seek holiness in our lives through our own Jewish practice, and seek to inspire others to do so as well. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Stephen Waldman, will explore how we've been able to guarantee religious freedom in America and where the current threats to it lie. Find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
After a flurry of rockets fired into Israel by Palestinian terrorists in Gaza and Israeli military responses that left 4 Israelis dead and 25 Palestinians dead last week, a ceasefire was arranged just in time for Israeli Memorial Day, Yom HaZikaron, and Israeli Independence Day, Yom HaAtzmaut, last week. The intention is for that fragile peace to last through the Eurovision Song Competition being held in Israel this coming week. In the attacks and response, Palestinian terrorist groups, specifically Hamas and Islamic Jihad, launched nearly 700 rockets from the Gaza Strip into southern Israel, according to the IDF. Israel responded with a barrage of air and tank strikes, totaling 350 by the morning. Israel also used targeted airstrikes and reportedly killed a mid-level Hamas operative while he was in a car on a Gaza street. This was Israel's first targeted killing since 2014, 5 years ago. While Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile defense performed pretty well, some of the many rockets got through, killing a few people in more remote areas. In the unofficial ceasefire agreement, Israel allowed more money supplied from Qatar to get through to help fund Hamas, and eased restrictions on Palestinian fishermen in the Mediterranean. Israeli military sources believe that Hamas and Islamic Jihad are preparing to launch another war against Israel sometime next year, likely 2020. We certainly hope not. In Manhattan, a dozen rabbis from all the major denominations of American Judaism met with a publisher and editorial page editor of the New York Times regarding the anti-Semitic cartoon that it published and its general coverage of Israel. The meeting last week at the Times offices in Midtown Manhattan lasted an hour and a half. It was organized through the New York Board of Rabbis, a large and influential interdenominational group. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, the group's executive vice president, said that A.G. Sulzberger and James Bennett, the publisher and editorial page editor of the Times, owned the problem of the cartoon being anti-Semitic. That cartoon, which was published last month in the opinion section of the New York Times International Edition, depicted Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu as a dog on a leash leading a blind President Donald Trump. Trump was drawn wearing a yarmulke, and Netanyahu's collar had a Star of David. The Times has apologized for the cartoon and published a staff editorial criticizing it. The newspaper said it has updated its unconscious bias training in the wake of the controversy, disciplined the editor who published the cartoon, and dropped the syndication service that provided it. It gave everyone a chance to express their feelings, Potasnik said. Everyone was very forthright, frank about what they felt. It was a healthy, honest exchange, and that's what's necessary. Potasnik said the majority of the meeting was spent discussing the Times' coverage of Israel, which many pro-Israel advocates have long viewed as negative. He said Sulzberger and Bennett were receptive to the rabbi's comments, and the group planned on meeting again. It's the reporting issue, he said. What's the culture at the Times vis-a-vis Israel? All those issues came up. The cartoon was the beginning of the conversation, but not the majority of it. In other news, the president of Williams College criticized a decision by his own student council not to recognize a pro-Israel campus group. Last month, the council at the prestigious Small Liberal Arts College in Williamston, Mass., voted not to admit the Williams Initiative for Israel as a recognized student group. In a statement last week, the college's president, Maud Mandel, said that the transcript of the debate and vote indicate the decision was made on political grounds. "I'm disappointed the council did not follow its own processes and bylaws," she said, noting that the council's bylaws do not mention political views as a criterion for student group recognition. The Williams Student Council voted April 23rd against recognizing the pro-Israel group after student activists expressed concerns about its support for Israeli policies regarding Palestinians. This is the first time in over a decade that a student group was rejected at Williams after complying with council bylaws. Minutes from the meeting itself show. Molly Barenbaum, one of the leaders of the pro-Israel group, said the students wanted to provide another point of view on campus. "I do think that some of being a student is encountering intellectual ideas that make one very uncomfortable," she said in an interview with the Williams Record, the student newspaper. "I think that the answer to encountering these ideas is to engage with them and to respond with your own perspective, rather than trying to shut them down and silence the information." Mandel said the Williams Initiative for Israel would still be able to operate on campus and access all services available to student groups per university policy. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Stephen Waldman. He's the author of Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom, the author of the best-selling Founding Faith, founder of BeliefNet, really interesting and important voice on religious liberty and on American politics and thought today. You mentioned in our earlier conversation on the show that it took another 100 years after the end of the Civil War and the 14th Amendment for courts to really begin enforcing or applying the principle of religious liberty in a broader sense. Can you talk about that process a little bit?
Yeah, for a long time, the 14th Amendment didn't get interpreted by the Supreme Court as applying the Bill of Rights down on the local level. And that was for religious freedom as well as for the other parts of the Bill of Rights. And then one by one, the court started to do it. And the case that they applied the religious liberty, one of them was involving Jehovah's Witnesses. Jehovah's Witnesses were still are, but in the 1940s were a particularly unpopular religious minority because they opposed the draft, wouldn't salute the American flag. So they were in the midst of World War One and World War Two. They were very unpopular and
considered
local governments
patriotic and so on.
Exactly, and brutally persecuted. I mean, beaten up, castrated in one case, but they persisted and they brought legal challenges, and it eventually got to the Supreme Court. And it was during those Jehovah's Witness cases that the court said that actually the 14th Amendment applies the First Amendment to local communities, and we have to have religious freedom in every nook and cranny of the country. And it is possible for a city council to infringe on your religious liberty just as much as the U.S. Congress. So that was a real breakthrough, and it happened around the World War II period.
You know, after World War II, it's interesting to think about the ways, as you describe really quite powerfully, that the post-World War II, the Cold War presidents used religion as a kind of, I don't want to say weapon, but as an important vehicle for identity, and religious freedom in America is an important aspect of the Cold War, which led to greater religious freedom. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think that's true, and I think it was especially important for the Jewish community in the United States. World War II really was a turning point in the sense that the presidents of the pre-war, post-war period, so Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower, really did view religious liberty as one of the weapons against first fascism and then communism. that this was something that distinguished us from them. And that was a bit of a shift. We owed it, previously they had talked about divine providence, meaning religion was an important distinction for America or an important asset. Now we're saying religious freedom was an important asset. It was also around that time that you started to hear the phrase Judeo-Christian. So it was at that moment that Jews and Catholics, to some degree, were kind of fully invited into the table. And you had these really interesting efforts that were going on around the same time to promote interfaith understanding, these what they call tolerance trios. These are trios of a rabbi, a minister, and a priest,
right,
going around the country, going to military bases. And it was part of us showing the world that we had this thing called religious freedom that made democracy worth fighting for and gave moral clarity to the mission of defeating both the fascists and then ultimately the communists.
One of the, I think, really fascinating aspects of America is we are, at least in our own minds, much more religious than other westernized nations. You go to England and, I don't know, 10 or 15% of the people say they go to church. In America, something close to 80%, 75, 80% say that they regularly practice religion, whatever that means. Why do you think that is?
Well, I do think part of that is this unusual model of religious liberty that developed. And it's not the same as secularism, and it's not the same as the government pushing a particular religion. And I really kind of go back to Madison's original insights on this, where he was a big supporter of separation of church and state, but not for the reasons that maybe some would think. He wanted separation of church and state because he thought it would make us all more religious. So he wasn't arguing for it because he wanted a secular society. He was arguing for it because he believed in a almost sort of a free market approach to religion, that if left unobstructed, people will find their path to God in a more honest, meaningful, and energetic way, and that will lead to better religion, in effect. It was really fascinating that there was this moment about 30 years later when he was an old man, and someone was asking him to kind of assess the success of the First Amendment, and he said it was a big success, not surprisingly.
Yeah.
But the reasons were really interesting. He didn't go on a whole thing about how there's less persecution or there's less discrimination, and that proves the First Amendment was a good idea. He says, you can tell the First Amendment worked because look at all this religion we have. Look at this religious vibrancy, and the minister, he even says the quality of the ministers seems to be better, and people are going to their houses of worship now more than they ever did before. And it was so interesting that he looked at it that way. And I think so, to flash forward to, you're right, we are this unusual case. Usually, as countries get more affluent, they get less religious.
Right, right, absolutely.
You know, if you look at it on a chart, you either have low-income, very religious countries, or high-income, very secular countries. And we're this odd exception that's off in the corner of being both affluent and religious. And I do think that it's this sort of pluralistic model that allows for experimentation and freedom and doesn't have the government putting its finger, even in a well-intentioned way, to promote particular religions.
You know, when I think about persecution, you know, we have this perspective that, oh, it's the old world that always persecuted people. I have a lot of Mormon friends, and there's an odd shared experience because Mormons were horribly persecuted early in their process. They were not the only religious group so persecuted. Do you think that kind of persecution still can happen in today's America?
Unfortunately, I do. And, you know, the Mormon case really was really stunning to me as well. I knew some about it, but not until I got deep into the research did I realize how bad it was. I mean, just as an example, there was an actual official order from the governor of Missouri in the 1830s calling for the extermination of the Mormons in the state of Missouri.
Yeah, it was genocide, basically. I
mean, yeah, it was official call for genocide. And so they really were very persecuted. Now, we kept getting better and better at this. This is, I think, kind of brick by brick, this model of religious freedom has been built through a few hundred years. What scares me right now is mostly the nature of the attacks on American Muslims, not just because it's bad for American Muslims, but you're seeing a lot of the same rhetoric and messages that we heard against in previous generations against Catholics and Mormons and Jews and others. For instance, one of the things you would hear, especially against Mormons and Catholics in the 19th century, was it's not even really a religion. It's like a political system. And, you know, in the case of Catholics, it's because it was a foreign potentate that was calling the shots.
Yeah, the Pope, you know, you talk about the Al Smith election and all of that, the sort of anti-Catholic sentiment, right?
Yeah, they weren't just arguing it on sort of theological grounds. It was like this was a foreign power,
right?
And it wasn't even really a religion. And they said similar things about Mormons. So and then about 10 years ago, you started to hear the same thing about Muslims in America. Right. You know, it's not really a religion. And well, what that does is, if it's not really a religion, then it doesn't really merit the protection of the First Amendment. It opens the door for really serious restrictions. And of course, the most serious of those that were proposed were President Trump's during the campaign, of the idea of a registry for American Muslims and the ban on
immigration,
which had never happened before. So those are, and then on top of that, the other thing that worries me is that, in addition to the fact that you've never really had the President of the United States kind of participating as directly in a kind of erosion of religious freedom as you do now, you also have this new media system, the digital media system, that allows for the spread of extremism of all sorts, but including the sort that erodes religious freedom. So it on the one hand, I kind of have a very mixed feeling about this right now. On the one hand, I feel like our religious freedom model in many ways is more advanced and secure than it's ever been. But just in the last 5 to 10 years, you saw this really, I thought, pretty shocking challenge to that. There was a poll that came out in 2016 that said half of Republicans polled were not willing to say that Islam should be legal in America. And that was sort of when I first thought, wow, the consensus really can unravel pretty quickly. You think it's built up over hundreds of years, it can't get so easily chipped away. But, you know, we take for granted some of our rights, how we got them. And we probably need to do a little more discussion of how we got them and why they're so important, and also their fragility if we abandon them.
You know, and it's particularly fascinating. One of the points you make in the book is how George W. Bush, in the aftermath of 9/11, 2001, spoke up and made a distinction between American Muslims and those who were radicalized. And in a way, that helped protect Muslims. It's come a long way in that time.
It was really an important moment. And I am sure that both my liberal and conservative friends will be surprised at my treatment of George Bush in this, but I actually put him right up there with the other great presidents of American history, at least for this one moment, in how he handled religious liberty and Islam in the aftermath of 9/11, when it could have been a just absolutely horrendous situation of attacks. Could have been totally disastrous. And he handled it brilliantly. And it was mostly through what you just said, which is just making the distinction between American Muslims who are patriotic and your neighbors and fighting for the same things that you are, and that's radical Islam that led the attacks on 9/11. It sounds like an obvious thing that these are two different people and two different groups of people, but that line is continually blurred. And that's when the really dangerous stuff happens, is when just people start to think of like, oh, the Muslim owner of the business down the block is pretty much kind of the same thing as Osama bin Laden. They're both Muslim, and that's what Muslims do. And so those lines get blurred. And you, this was an issue in past history as well. You would, whenever someone would be attacking a Mormon or a Catholic or a Jew, they would take whatever the worst stereotypes, or let's not even say stereotypes, worst actual examples of an actual Catholic, and ascribe that to all Catholics or all Jews or all Muslims.
Stereotyping the whole religion or the whole, almost as a species. I want to thank Stephen Wallman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book Sacred Liberty, you know, we just kind of scratched the surface, but it's really an outstanding work about how religious freedom was gained and earned here in America. Steve, where can people go to find out more about you?
Well, I have a website on the book and on religious liberty called sacredliberty.us, and it has articles and documents on this topic and on the book and a little bit about me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Really enjoyed it. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Tom Weidlinger, author of the new biography, The Restless Hungarian. Our playout this morning comes from a recent and silly Israeli dance tune about, well, an evening misspent. From Eyal Golan and Ofer Nisim, it's called Lo Mevina Ivrit, doesn't speak Hebrew. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. איך היא נכנסת עם הפוזה של האלפיון 20 קראת יהלומים וזה רק השעון אני יודע שהלילה לא אלך לישון מזמינה אותי לדרינק בבר של המלון איך היא אוהבת להגיד I'm from Beverly Hills אני עונה לה עם מבטא I'm from the Middle East הגוף שלה עליי זה ממוטט אותי סופי קורא לה מותק אבל היא לא מבינה לא מבינה עברית לא היא לא מבינה
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.